We begin Chapter 5, Renunciation. In the Yoga of Integral Knowledge, this was seen first on the 15th of April, 1916, in his journal Arya. The first article, of course, in each issue of Arya, so long as it continued, was The Life Divine. And that was titled The Ascent of Life. Then came the synthesis of yoga, and then commentary on the Kena Upanishad. So we look today at the context in which a principle that has dominated some aspects of Indian spirituality finds a fitting place in the integral yoga. The subject is renunciation. We'll see that Sri Aurobindo uses it in a precise way and does not let it take too great a position in the practice. So let's begin. Chapter 5, Renunciation. If discipline of all the members of our being by purification and concentration may be described as the right arm of the body of yoga, renunciation is its left arm. By discipline or positive practice, we confirm in ourselves the truth of things, truth of being, truth of knowledge, truth of love, truth of works, and replace with these the falsehoods that have overgrown and perverted our nature. By renunciation, we seize upon the falsehoods, pluck up their roots, and cast them out of our way so that they shall no longer hamper by their persistence, their resistance, or their recurrence, the happy and harmonious growth of our divine living. Renunciation is an indispensable instrument of our perfection. So if first we replace elements of our nature with their divine corollaries as the positive end of the growth, we must displace the things that don't belong or which continue to be errant, which are not part of our intended divine living. How far shall this renunciation go? What shall be its nature? And in what way shall it be applied? There is an established tradition, long favored by great religious teachings and by men of profound spiritual experience, that renunciation must not only be complete as a discipline, but definite and final as an end, and that it shall fall nothing short of the renunciation of life itself and of our mundane existence. So without names, he's referring, of course, to the great traditions of the Shramana, those who take the difficult path, Mahavira, who founded Jainism, Buddha, who founded, obviously, Buddhism, and Shankara, who set into ground, finally, after 1,000 or more years of resistance, in what we would come to call Hinduism, the idea that renunciation, asceticism, would be welcome. Because it was not. None of these Shramanic traditions find their root in the Veda. The Veda was very much a life-affirming enterprise. The Upanishads are, despite claims of Advaita Vedanta, very positive in their view of life. So we do not find the renunciation of life as an aim in anything that's connected to Veda. We find instead that there is a fulfillment of life by gaining access to the divine consciousness that originates all the worlds, all the beings of all the worlds, and all the forces of all the worlds. It is in that established oneness that one lives free of ego, that one lives free of suffering, that one lives in the fullness of divine delight. But back to renunciation and this established tradition long favored. Many causes have contributed to the growth of this pure, lofty, and august tradition. There is, first, the profounder cause of the radical opposition between the sullied and imperfect nature of life in the world, as it now is in the present stage of our human evolution, and the nature of spiritual living. And this opposition has led to the entire rejection of world existence as a lie, an insanity of the soul, a troubled and unhappy dream, or at best, a flawed, specious, and almost worthless good, or to its characterization as a kingdom of the world, the flesh and the devil, and therefore, for the divinely led and divinely attracted soul, only a place of ordeal and preparation, or at best, a play of the all existence, a game of cross purposes which he tires of and abandons. So there are a lot of associations within this. This whole idea about the renunciation of life comes back to a principal verb, sannyas, to throw down together. Sam and nyas. So it is the idea of taking it all and tossing it. I'm sick of it. Sannyasa means, therefore, the throwing down of the world. I'm finished. The idea that the nature of the world is imperfect, of course, something also we don't find in the Veda. It is apparent that the world is transient. It is apparent that not everybody gets to fulfill their desires to the nth degree. But this requires us to look at a soul which is separate from the world. This requires us to say that there is a Purusha here that needs to be free from the claims of nature. This idea, again, of a spiritual division between the real spiritual self here and the pretend naturally formed self out there is something we do not find in the Veda. It also does not have a Vedic origination. So this first thing that Sri Aurobindo calls us to is this unbridgeable gulf, this division between the pure spiritual being and this ugly life here in time and space. This is reminiscent of the Gnostic philosophies which come to us through the Neoplatonic traditions in Greece. So that's point one. The idea of an all existence which is playing a game with itself. This is, of course, the idea of a lila. Of course, a game can be serious in its intent. It can have a good positive purpose. But if the idea is that it's simply a trifle, that the universe is a meaningless momentary diversion from the infinite's self-concentration within itself, that too is not the point of the Veda and the richness of its tradition. The second, now, a second cause is the soul's hunger for personal salvation, for escape into some farther or farthest height of unalloyed bliss and peace, untroubled by the labor and the struggle. Or else it is its unwillingness to return from the ecstasy of the divine embrace into the lower field of work and service, so called away to this unalloyed bliss, this inexplicable experience beyond the categories of existence, nirvana, a blowing out of the impermanent self, into a great moksha, liberation from all of this evil, a seating into shanti, so that one is ever in peace. So if the first was this unbridgeable gulf, the second reason to take renunciation and throw away the world is to save oneself, because one personally feels a repulsion towards the world. But there are other slighter causes incidental to spiritual experience, strong feeling and practical proof of the great difficulty, which we willingly exaggerate into an impossibility of combining the life of works and action with spiritual peace and the life of realization. Or else the joy which the mind comes to take in the mere act and state of renunciation, as it comes indeed to take joy in anything that it has attained to or which it has inured itself, and the sense of peace and deliverance which is gained by indifference to the world and to the objects of man's desire. So this third is a bet that this is an improbable cause. We can never change the world. Straighten the dog's tail. As soon as you release the tail, it reverts back to its original shape. Why should we wrestle with it? Unless, of course, we like asceticism simply for the sake of the practice. We like to renounce because it gives us a sense of superiority. It gives us a sense of accomplishment. We can be like the supercilious monks who look down upon all the world, you know, august and serene from their pure altitudes. Two, we might note that the asuras have a certain lust for the practice of asceticism. They love to do tapas because it gives them more and more power. Control over themselves extends into control over the world, which they very much quest for. So there are other reasons too. Lowest causes of all are the weakness that shrinks from the struggle, the disgust and disappointment of the soul baffled by the great cosmic labor, the selfishness that cares not what becomes of those left behind us so long as we personally can be free from the monstrous, ever-circling wheel of death and rebirth, the indifference to the cry that rises up from a laboring humanity. So from weakness, from selfishness, from indifference to another's troubles, we might also prefer to rid ourselves of the world. Very easy to get peace for yourself when you don't have to care a whit about what else is going on around you. For the sadhaka of an integral yoga, none of these reasons are valid. With weakness and selfishness, however spiritual in their guise or trend, we can have no dealing. A divine strength and courage and a divine compassion and helpfulness are the very stuff of that which he should be. They are that very nature of the divine which he would take upon himself as a robe of spiritual light and beauty. This is virya. This is mahakaruna. The revolvings of the great wheel bring to him no sense of terror or giddiness. He rises above it in his soul and knows from above their divine law and their divine purpose. He's seated there, udasinata, in the higher principles, the tattvas from which all things come flowing down, and understanding the play of the cosmos, why would he fear? The difficulty of harmonizing the divine life with human living, of being in God and yet living in man, is the very difficulty that he is set here to solve and not to shun. He has learned that the joy, the peace, and the deliverance are an imperfect crown and no real possession if they do not form a state secure in itself, inalienable to the soul, not dependent on aloofness and inaction, but firm in the storm and the race and the battle. Unsullied, whether by the joy of the world or by its suffering, the ecstasy of the divine embrace will not abandon him because he obeys the impulse of divine love for God in humanity. Or if it seems to draw back from him for a while, he knows by experience that it is to try and test him still farther, so that some imperfection in his own way of meeting it may fall away from him. Personal salvation he does not seek, except as a necessity for the human fulfillment, and because he who is himself in bonds cannot easily free others, though to God nothing is impossible. For a heaven of personal joys, he has no hankerings, even as a hell of personal sufferings has for him no terrors. If there is an opposition between the spiritual life and that of the world, it is that gulf which he is here to bridge, that opposition which he is here to change into a harmony. If the world is ruled by the flesh and the devil, all the more reason that the children of immortality should be here to conquer it for God and the Spirit. If life is an insanity, then there are so many million souls to whom there must be brought the light of divine reason. If a dream, yet is it real within itself to so many dreamers who must be brought either to dream nobler dreams or to awaken. Or if a lie, then the truth has to be given to the deluded. Nor, if it be said that only by the luminous example of escape from the world can we help the world, shall we accept that dogma, since the contrary example of great avatars is there to show that not only by rejecting the life of the world as it is can we help, but also and more by accepting and uplifting it. And if it is a play of the all existence, then we may well consent to play out our part in it with grace and courage, well take delight in the game along with our divine playmate. So there is much here. We are not seeking personal salvation. We live here in solidarity with the world. If we go first to free ourselves, it's because we have no power with which to free anybody else until we have done that. If we would liberate others from ignorance and ego, we must ourselves be free from ignorance, live essentially in the Spirit, and abolish the dominance of ego in our own life. The world is not a lie. It is not mithya. It is a truth, satyam. And if we dream, let us not dream from the mind. Let us dream from the superconscient and seek to make those greater dreams real here. And we need look no farther than Rama and Krishna, even Parashurama, to see that truth can be installed in this world as it is ready to receive it only by those who are willing to live a greater truth. We must find that truth in our soul, give it force of life in the flesh of the body, and meet every obstacle every contagion, every limitation, straight, without flinching. And courage and consciousness will carry us to victory. And all that we do, however much courage we have, where does the courage come from? Where does the light come from? From that supreme being who pours that into us. This world is not a lie. If it is a play, it is a play of delight. If we work for the world, we do it from loka sangraha, because we want to hold the worlds together. We all want to arrive at the same place. We want to leave nothing behind. We are traveling together as a luminous cosmos, growing more luminous by the moment. And I don't mean to contradict the evident truths that are there in the spiritual discoveries that Advaita, Buddhism, and Jainism have offered to us. But we must achieve here and now. Ihaiva. This is the larger goal of the Bodhisattva, as I think we were saying recently. The idea that I will not accept enlightenment until every sentient being before me has been enlightened is a little reversed. We must become free to free others. We must have power to share before we can liberate and ask someone else to throw off the chains. That only comes through spiritual victory in a meaningful way. Sri Aurobindo continues, but most of all, the view we have taken of the world forbids the renunciation of world existence so long as we can be anything to God and man in their working out of its purposes. We regard the world not as an invention of the devil or a self-delusion of the soul, but as a manifestation of the divine, although as yet a partial, because a progressive and evolutionary manifestation. So he makes allusions here to the idea that the world is invested in evil, that Gnostic view. There it is perfect and beautiful. Here it is ugly and tortured. So we must reject this to get that. Or the idea that it is self-delusion, that we have mistaken the rope for a snake. We see a world where there is really only the unity of undivided, unmanifested Brahman. Sri Aurobindo rejects both of those worldviews. Therefore, for us, renunciation of life cannot be the goal of life, nor rejection of the world the object for which the world was created. We seek to realize our unity with God, but for us, that realization involves a complete and absolute recognition of our unity with man, and we cannot cut the two asunder. To use Christian language, the Son of God is also the Son of Man, and both elements are necessary to the complete Christhood. Or to use an Indian form of thought, the divine Narayana, of whom the universe is only one ray, is revealed and fulfilled in man. The complete man is Nara Narayana, and in that completeness, he symbolizes the supreme mystery of existence. To unpack that a little, Nara is the word in Sanskrit for man. Narayana is the cosmic spirit, the supreme divine person who has become all this in the universe. Sri Aurobindo suggests here it is when the two are suffused, become one, when the divine is coincident with the human, that you have the complete manifestation in humanity of the divine. Narayana, by the way, is the Vedic Rishi who composed the Purusha Sukta. In the Rig Veda, that's the 10th mandala, the 90th hymn. You see this combination of Nara and Narayana after the Rig Veda in the Taittiriya Aranyaka. And you see it, of course, many times in the Mahabharata and then later books like the Puranas. Shatapatha Brahmana also. Therefore, renunciation must be for us merely an instrument and not an object, nor can it be the only or the chief instrument, since our object is the fulfillment of the divine in the human being, a positive aim which cannot be reached by negative means. The negative means can only be for the removal of that which stands in the way of the positive fulfillment. And this is assonant with what he noted in his personal yoga, in the record of yoga. The negative means can only be for the removal of that which stands in the way of the positive fulfillment. So the left hand does its work, but the right hand accomplishes the most. It must be a renunciation, a complete renunciation of all that is other than and opposed to the divine self-fulfillment, and a progressive renunciation of all that is a lesser or only a partial achievement. So renunciation also, not simply of untoward elements which are clear to us and which we can exclude from our continued life and common practice, but also things that might be great achievements now, things that might be realizations, recognitions that we have embodied, have later to be let go of, because we must become more than we were. So why carry every piece of luggage with us? We carry the essence of the experience and not all the baggage. We carry the lessons learned, the consciousness built as we go forward and discover new truths. We shall have no attachment to our life in the world. If that attachment exists, we must renounce it and renounce utterly. But neither shall we have any attachment, sangam, to the escape from the world, to salvation, to the great self-annihilation, sannyas. If that attachment exists, that also we must renounce, and renounce it utterly. Sri Aurobindo is alluding here to the Bhagavad Gita, yes? In the second chapter, shlokas 47 and 48, you have a right to action, karmani, never to the fruits. Paleshu. Don't let the fruits of action be your motive. Fixed in yoga, yogastha. Do your works, abandoning attachment, equal in failure or success. Equality, samatvam, is yoga. Again, our renunciation must obviously be an inward renunciation, especially and above all, a renunciation of attachment and the craving of desire in the senses and the heart, of self-will in the thought and action, and of egoism in the center of the consciousness. So here again, Sri Aurobindo refers back to the Gita, which makes a very plain point that the renunciation we seek is not outer. It is not whether you drop the trappings of life that makes you clear of sangam, of attachment, but the inner component. So it is tyaga, abandonment, not sannyasa, the throwing down of things. If inwardly you release yourself from ownership, that is the treasure. And look at these three things that he's named here. Desire in the senses and the heart, of self-will and thought and action, egoism in the center of consciousness. This is the ladder of Prakriti. So in recognizing that you take away this egoity, it is not my desire that has to be fulfilled. I can't get gratification through these things in my soul. It is not my precious thoughts which are most valid. That is not what authenticates my soul. And it is not this sense of myself against all others which is the truth of my soul. These things all are natural formations. These are the perturbations of nature, of Prakriti. So the Gita says, not by abstention from work does one enjoy actionlessness, naishkarmya, nor by mere renunciation does he reach fulfillment, siddhi. It is something else that puts you there. The renouncing of acts of desire, sages call sannyasa. The abandonment of the fruits of action, the wise call tyaga. So the first that I read was chapter 3, shloka 4, and this was the 18th, the culminating book, shloka 2. Back to these three. For these things are the three knots by which we are bound to our lower nature, and if we can renounce these utterly, there is nothing else that can bind us. Therefore, attachment and desire must be utterly cast out. There is nothing in the world to which we must be attached. Not wealth, nor poverty, nor joy, nor suffering, nor life, nor death, nor greatness, nor littleness, nor vice, nor virtue, nor friend, nor wife, nor children, nor country, nor our work and mission, nor heaven, nor earth, nor all that is within them or beyond them. And this does not mean that there is nothing at all that we shall love, nothing in which we shall take delight, for attachment is egoism in love, and not love itself. Desire is limitation and insecurity in a hunger for pleasure and satisfaction, and not the seeking after the divine delight in things. A universal love we must have, calm and yet eternally intense, beyond the brief vehemence of the most violent passion. A delight in things rooted in a delight in God that does not adhere to their forms, but to that which they conceal in themselves, and that embraces the universe without being caught in its meshes. And that's the Taittiriya Upanishad, chapter 10. Have a read. And it says, pursue him. It is positive. Find that secret divine in all these forms, find that divine at the center of all material formations. Find that divine at the center of all life's vibrations. Find that divine in the most crystalline of thoughts. Find that divine in what is beyond thought, in that great consciousness of the Vijnana. Find the divine in that ananda, that bliss from which all things come. And then you're in my world, says he who inspires the seer of the Taittiriya. That supreme person is the divine love and ananda. Sri Aurobindo has a footnote here. Without being caught in its meshes, nirlipta, which means unsmeared. You're not tainted by your experience in the world. Nirlipta, the divine ananda in things, is nishkama and nirlipta, free from desire and therefore not attached. This idea of nishkama, we often think nishkama karma is a phrase in the Gita. If it is, I haven't been able to find it, but I know it's in the Shatapatha Brahmana and it's in the Manu Sutras, Manu Smriti, and it may be elsewhere. It means without desire. Nirlipta is a word that does not occur in the Gita also, but it's in the Brahma Vaivarta Purana. So these things have been around for a long time, these great truths. Perhaps they got recorded in scriptures. Perhaps they were part of oral traditions, but they are part of our current experience. Because we can be actively engaged in the world, doing works perfectly and making mistakes one after the other, and be uncaught by the meshes because we live in the purity of the soul. Yes, nobody expects you to be perfect, but if you're perfectly grounded in your soul, all imperfections are washed away, and you are unsmeared in essence. Don't try to be perfect. Try to be perfectly in your soul. So, I think that's a good place to put our bookmarks. Let's read from Savitri. This is a section early in the book. This is in book one, the Book of Beginnings. This is in canto four, The Secret Knowledge. This is on page 59. Alive in a dead rotating universe, we whirl not here upon a casual globe, abandoned to a task beyond our force. Even through the tangled anarchy called fate, and through the bitterness of death and fall, an outstretched hand is felt upon our lives. It is near us in unnumbered bodies and births. In its unslackening grasp, it keeps for us safe the one inevitable supreme result no will can take away and no doom change, the crown of conscious immortality. The Godhead promised to our struggling souls when first man's heart dared death and suffered life. One who has shaped this world is ever its Lord. Our errors are his steps upon the way. He works through the fierce vicissitudes of our lives. He works through the hard breath of battle and toil. He works through our sins and sorrows and our tears. His knowledge overrules our nescience. Whatever the appearance we must bear, whatever our strong ills and present fate, when nothing we can see but drift and bail, A mighty guidance leads us still through all. After we have served this great divided world, God's bliss and oneness are our inborn right. A date is fixed in the calendar of the unknown, an anniversary of the birth sublime. Our soul shall justify its checkered walk. All will come near that now is naught or far. These calm and distant mites shall act at last, immovably ready for their destined task. The ever-wise, compassionate brilliances await the sound of the incarnate's voice to leap and bridge the chasms of ignorance and heal the hollow, yearning gulfs of life and fill the abyss that is the universe. Here, meanwhile, at the spirit's opposite pole, in the mystery of the deeps that God has built for his abode below the thinker's sight, in this compromise of a stark absolute truth, with the light that dwells near the dark end of things, in this tragic comedy of divine disguise, this long far seeking for joy ever near, in the grandiose dream of which the world is made, in this gold dome on a black dragon base, the conscious force that acts in nature's breast, a dark-robed laborer in the cosmic scheme, carrying clay images of unborn gods, executrix of the inevitable idea, hampered, enveloped by the hoops of fate, patient trustee of slow eternal time, absolves from hour to hour her secret charge. All she foresees in masked imperative depths, the dumb intention of the unconscious gulfs, answers to a will that sees upon the heights, and the evolving word's first syllable, ponderous, brute-sensed, contains its luminous close, privy to a summit victory's vast descent, and the portent of the soul's immense uprise. So, Namaste, Jai Ma. Answer his challenge. Rise up, soul. Be free. Renounce only ignorance and limitation. Be that being. You are that one. Here, Narayana. You are Nara. Much love to you all. Be champions. You are champions. Namaste.